This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.
When I hear stories about the kids who really get addicted, over and over again, parents and the kids use the metaphor of being taken away. Like, my kid, my beautiful, funny kid, who she was so happy, she's gone. Like, where did she go? And then, like, they'll say, we sent her to summer camp for 3 weeks with no phones. And when she came back, my child was back. I had my child back. She was funny. She was happy. And then she got back on her phone and she went away again. So this metaphor of being taken away to an alien place, which is a horrible place, no child should grow up there. That's where we are.
The Village Square, a nervy bunch of liberals and conservatives who believe that disagreement and dialogue make for a good conversation, a good country, and a good time. At the Village Square, we talk about politics, religion, and race. You know, the topics your mom taught you never to discuss in polite company. Listen, at the Village Square, we make pigs fly.
Hey, folks, welcome to Village Squarecast. This is Corey Nathan. I am so glad to be with you again. Thank you for joining us for Jonathan Haidt, The Anxious Generation. Funding for this program was provided through a grant from Florida Humanities with funds from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Check out Florida Humanities online at floridahumanities.org. You may have noticed that we just recently shared a lengthy conversation we were fortunate enough to have with social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership at NYU's Stern School of Business, Dr. Jonathan Haidt. During a lot of the first half of that conversation, we did a deep dive into a piece he contributed to The Atlantic titled, Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid. Which I love, as if we weren't stupid enough. No, we've been uniquely stupid over the last 10 years. But he, in that piece, he asks what it must have been like. He starts it out by this great helpful illustration on what it must have been like to live in the days after Babel. Really helpful to illustrate the pickle that we as a society find ourselves in today. So you could go back and check out that episode from a couple months ago. It's called The Fragmentation of Everything. But in the second half of the conversation, we get into his latest book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And since we shared our talk with Dr. Haidt, it was prior to the book coming out, and especially with The Anxious Generation, with the book just absolutely blowing up. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's earned all kinds of praise from other scholars and writers literally from around the world. We thought it'd be good to revisit that part of our conversation with John when we explore some of the revelations from the new book. It was a real treat for me to be able to co-host this program along with Village Square's founder and CEO, my dear friend, Liz Joyner. But before we start, it's my pleasure to reintroduce you to our honored guest. Jonathan Haidt is the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. He received his PhD in social psychology from the University of Pennsylvania and then did postdoctoral research at the University of Chicago. He taught at UVA, the University of Virginia, for 16 years before moving to NYU Stern in 2011. He was named one of the top global thinkers by Foreign Policy magazine and one of the top world thinkers by Prospect magazine. His research focuses on morality, its emotional foundations, cultural variations, and developmental course. He is the co-developer of Moral Foundations Theory and of the research site yourmorals.org. He's a co-founder of heterodoxacademy.org, which advocates for viewpoint diversity in higher education. And he uses his research to help people understand and respect the moral motives of their enemies, such as in his TED Talks and elsewhere. He's the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, and with Greg Lukianoff, The Coddling of the American Mind, how good intentions and bad ideas are setting a generation up for failure. And like I said, we'll be talking about the newest book, The Anxious Generation, today. So with that, here's Dr. Jonathan Haidt, along with Liz Joyner and me, as John introduces the new book, The Anxious Generation.
We absolutely have to, right away, starting today, change what's happening to young people, because we have so interfered with human development that it is crippling a generation. Okay, let's go there. Let's talk about the new book, because that's really what the whole book is about. Yeah. So if anyone has read my book with Greg Lukianoff, The Coddling of the American Mind, you know, we had a whole chapter on overprotection of children and children need to play. We said a lot of that there. And we speculated that maybe social media is also part of this, but in 2017, we weren't sure. Well, I've done a lot of research since then, and now I'm very confident. What happened in the United States is that mental health of teenagers was actually pretty stable from the 90s through about 2010, 2011. And then by 2013, it falls off a cliff, especially for girls. Every measure of anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicide, they all go shooting up in like a hockey stick pattern around 2012, 2013. And they keep going up. They're still going up today. And many people think it's COVID. It's not COVID. You look at the graphs. Yeah, COVID accelerated a little bit and then it came back, but it's just where it was. If there was COVID, was a blip. COVID, it seemed like a big deal, but it's nothing compared to whatever happened in the early 2010s. So my book is about that. What the hell happened? And I can say it very concisely. What happened is that humans have always had a play-based childhood, because like all mammals, our kids play. Kids are very playful. Puppies are playful. Kitties are playful. They have to play. And we kind of gradually stopped that in the 90s and early 2000s because we thought they'll be abducted if they're ever outside. We can't let them outside. We can't let them on. So we took away the play-based childhood gradually. And then all of a sudden, around 2010, 2011, we gave them a phone-based childhood. And so the key moment is when a millennial middle school kid, let's say a girl, traded in her flip phone, which is not, flip phones are fine. Flip phones, you communicate with one or two people. When she traded her flip phone for a smartphone with Instagram and a high-speed data connection, so she could spend 3 or 4 hours a day on it, she became the first member of Gen Z. And once, because most of the girls got on around 2013 when Facebook buys Instagram, that's when it becomes super popular. It's not just Instagram. I mean, it's the whole phone-based childhood. In 2010, very few teenagers had a smartphone. They were still on flip phones. In 2015, they almost all did. And they were on many hours a day. So I'm calling that period, 2010 to 2015, the great rewiring of childhood. We used to have a childhood before the 80s. We had a childhood where kids would be out, they'd play, they would get into trouble, they would get lost, they'd find their way back. That's how you learn to become a self-governing person. You work together to solve problems. But by 2010, we'd stop that. We don't let them become self-governing. And instead we said, here's a phone. And you know, as soon as you give your kid a phone, it's an experience blocker. It's going to basically be in front of their face most of the day, and they're not going to have many other experiences. Almost everything comes through the phone. All dating now goes through the phone. So I think that's what happened, and that's why mental health fell off a cliff. And if the American experiment is an experiment in self-governance, and we somehow worked ourselves into the situation where we do not let our kids practice self-governance. You cannot have any practice becoming self-governance, because what if you get into a fight? What if someone gets hurt? We have to have an adult there to supervise, settle disputes, and then we'll send you off to college. And then we college professors, like, what is going on? Why can't these kids take it if someone reads a Shakespeare book? Like, what is wrong with words now that people are so fragile? So the new book, The Anxious Generation, actually really does connect back to our common interest in democracy.
I was fascinated by the chapter Spiritual Elevation and Degradation, which hat tip to Liz for reminding me the title of the chapter. I was so engrossed in the chapter, I forgot the title of it. One of the reasons, though, and I want to back up for a second. One of the reasons, though, is because you identify as an atheist. Mm-hmm. So I want to back up, and I have a question about your personal background.
Sure.
I'm trying to picture you growing up around that table with your two sisters and your parents, who you clearly revere. Did you become clear on, or at least start to wonder whether there was a God or not, and started to lean towards, no, I'm an atheist. Mm-hmm. And if that was early enough, I'm curious how that conversation around the height dinner table went. Yeah. Did you get pushback from your sisters? Did Harold have an objection to it? How did that go?
Yeah. Well, so I was always like a science kid. I think analytically, I think about systems, I'm abstract. So for me, I know that I was not an atheist at my bar mitzvah. When I was 13, I didn't have any issues. I didn't think about, does God exist? Or at least but I know that by 14 or 15, I was having arguments with my best friend, Krister, whose father was a minister, a reverend, Episcopalian. So I know that by then I was just saying, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem likely. What do you think is more likely? This or that. And then as I learned about evolution, I read the Hebrew Bible when I was in college, read the whole thing, and I was shocked at a lot of the content. And if you take the Bible literally, and you're a sort of modern secular person, there's plenty of beautiful parts, but man, there's a lot of really, really bad stuff in there. If you take it literally. So all of that cemented in me a kind of a hostility to religion. And I was in a way destined to become a new atheist. So I was growing up, we're talking like the 80s and 90s here, but in the early 2000s, you get, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens writing these really, attack books about religion. And I was the sort of person who could well have become one of those. But because I was studying the evolution of morality, and I came to appreciate that religion is centrally tied to that, and I came to see, don't take it literally. And the key was Emile Durkheim, the sociologist Emile Durkheim. Durkheim said the key to religion is not the beliefs, like, do you believe in an afterlife? The key is that the beliefs and the behaviors all combine to create a community. It's about creating E pluribus unum. That's basically what it is. It's magic. There's alchemy you can do. You can take a bunch of people and you can put them together and create one. And that is almost a transubstantiation. That is transubstantiation, right? Am I using the word correctly? So once I came to appreciate that religion performs this miracle that makes modern liberal democracies possible, I had a lot more respect for it, because I don't take it literally. I see what it does. I see that it's part of our nature.
We really see that dynamic on the ground all the time when people come together in these really unique ways, and you see what happens. And it's actually really frustrating, because you think, well, we know what to do. We're just not doing it. So you start The Anxious Generation with another really amazing John Haidt metaphor. You want to say something about that? I think, if you looked at all the questions, we had like 100 questions. And when you look at all the questions, there are so many that refer to the rider and the elephant, mm-hmm. After Babel. So I predict this is going to be another metaphor that enters our common parlance.
Okay. All right. So again, I was casting around for, what happened to our kids? Why is it that kids born in 1997 are so messed up compared to kids born in 1993? Like, how did it happen? I mean, the mental illness rates are unbelievably different, just a few years apart. The key is, I think, especially early puberty, middle school, they had a very different experience from their older siblings. So I was looking for a metaphor for that. Like, what would be such a radical change away from a human environment, a human childhood? What would be so radically inhuman childhood? And I thought of the metaphor that, suppose a tech billionaire had the idea of, there's a race to Mars, like these guys are competing to get to Mars. And what if one of them had the idea, hey, let's bring kids to Mars, because let's let them go through puberty on Mars, lower gravity, different conditions, let their bodies adapt to Mars. And so he starts signing up kids. They don't need any parental permission. They have to say that they have parental permission. So you just have to check a box. Yeah, my parents are fine. Yeah. So we start sending kids to Mars. And we're all like, what the hell? What are you doing? And it turns out that he never, ever even thought about children's safety, which wasn't even a concern. There are no protections for children. They're treated like adults. And we have no idea if the changes are going to be permanent. That is, if your kid goes through puberty on Mars, low gravity, high radiation, are they going to ever be able to return to Earth, or are they permanently changed? Like, we would never, ever let a company take our children away without our knowledge or permission and raise them in danger. Like, that could never happen. And if a company tried that, we'd sue the hell out of them. Well, guess what? It's happening. And because of Section 230, it seems we can't do anything about it. And the reason why this metaphor works, I think, is because in my conversations with parents, first they feel helpless, they feel powerless, they feel, you know, like the main fight all across the developed world is over technology and don't spend all day on your phone. And so we're all struggling with this. And this was brought to us by companies that are basically exploiting our children for their profit. The evidence is mounting that they're harming them actually quite severely. And even though most kids are not mentally ill, it's maybe about a third, which is unbelievable. About a third of kids, I'd say, have an anxiety disorder, depression, something else. You know, about a third of kids are being really messed up by this technology. Now, normally, if it's 1 in 1,000 kids are severely damaged by a consumer product, we would sue the hell out of them and shut them down. But if it's 1 in 3, we don't do anything. And let's see, there was one other element that I wanted to get to here. Oh, yes. That when I hear stories about the kids who really get addicted, over and over again, parents and the kids use the metaphor of being taken away. Like, my kid, my beautiful, funny kid, who she was so happy, she's gone. Like, where did she go? And then, like, they'll say, we sent her to summer camp for 3 weeks with no phones. And when she came back, my child was back. I had my child back. She was funny. She was happy. And then she got back on her phone and she went away again. So this metaphor of being taken away to an alien place, which is a horrible place, no child should grow up there. That's where we are. And I didn't mention it yet. We've been talking about America. You can have whatever theories you want about what happened in America in 2012. Maybe it wasn't Facebook and Instagram. But the exact same thing happened at the exact same time in the exact same way in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and the Scandinavian countries. So in countries with a lot of individualism, and what we find is that the kids get washed away.
Just so incredibly sad and tragic. So you mentioned Section 230, and we had an audience question about what your perspective on that is.
Mm-hmm. So before so there were those Senate hearings a week or two ago where we saw the tech executives, Mark Zuckerberg in particular, basically dodging and weaving and, you know, questions, you know, but aren't kids being, you know, sexually propositioned and CSAM material and bullying and drugs? And they go, oh, yes, but, you know, we're going to cut down on that. You know, we have the world's best, you know, we can probably reduce it by, you know, 50%, whatever. So before those hearings, I thought, you know, I totally understand the need for Section 230. And for listeners who don't know, it was put up in, I think, 1996, I think it was. It was a section of the Communications Decency Act that said, you know, if you're AOL, you're running a bulletin board and people post something, like, the company can't be responsible for everything that everyone posts because they can't possibly edit it all. And so without that, there couldn't have been the internet. I understand the principle. And so until recently, I thought if they would just interpret Section 230 properly, narrowly, just so that you can't literally sue them because someone else posted something, then that would be that actually could make sense. Unfortunately, what's happened, I think some lower court decisions have interpreted it as broadly as possible, meaning you can't sue a social media company. You can't regulate them because anything you do might interfere with someone's ability to talk on it. Basically, it's been interpreted as a blanket liability shield, to be clear, a blanket liability shield. And this is what Francis Haugen and many others have really pointed out. Like, even if you agree with the principle, and I do see the principle, how can the company not be liable for the architectural decision that they made to make a product more addictive to children and then market that product to children? And they all go for the underage kids. They say 13, but they don't enforce it. None of them enforce it. So these are, you know, if any other industry, like if alcohol or gambling, if they were out recruiting kids on playgrounds and damaging them, we'd sue the hell out of them. There's only one other industry that has that protection. That's the gun industry. There's special laws for the gun industry. You can't sue a gun manufacturer because someone used their gun to kill your child. And it's the same with social media. You can't sue social media because it's addicted the entire world and is killing children. So yeah, I think Section 230 needs to go. I now think as a result of those hearings, it needs to just go and be replaced by a new law that's very narrowly tailored to do what the original law was supposed to do.
So this is an apt question, and I'm glad I'm drinking just for, because this okay. could be very depressing. But one of our participants asked very simply, what gives you hope?
Let's see. I have to be very careful how I answer this. So I'll just say, I think that we are in a time where the amount of chaos and fragmentation is going to increase possibly by a lot. So I don't have much hope for the short to medium term, actually. But what does give me some sanity and some inspiration is to see that we're at a juncture point in history, unlike any other, and to see it that, there are cycles of history, institutions decay, and then they get reborn about every 80 years. And we're one of those that was predicted long ago in 2020, 2025. That's basically where things are supposed to break and then come back together. And then we're at the end of a 500 year period, which we can call the Gutenberg era based on text. We're transitioning to network, and our institutions that were made for the Gutenberg era in America, constitutions, text, journalism, all that stuff, that may not be translatable to the network era. It might not work. So I think there are real possibilities of extraordinary things happening beyond what we can really imagine. That is frightening. And I am frightened about that, I must say. On the other hand, what gives me at least some inspiration is that the things that we do today, the things that we who are not on the extremes, the things that we who care about America, who think that America's done amazing things and is very much like Barack Obama. I mean, it's a process. We're getting better. We're making progress. Those of us in the exhausted majority, the things that we do really, really matter. And they didn't matter as much when I was growing up, in the 70s and 80s. It didn't matter that much what we did. And now it really, really does. And so I think we have a call to action. There was a Greatest Generation that was called up to fight fascism. And I think our challenge is different. It's much harder. But like the work that you're doing, I mean, the work like this is, I'm an atheist, but I'll say this is God's work. Like, and actually, from a Durkheimian perspective, it literally is God's work, because he said God is society. So I am, I'm not depressed. I'm not, I don't think the world is going to end. I think our democracy might become much more like those in Latin America that have been very unstable and that have had changes of constitution, changes of government, military involvement. We could have things like that, but we're going to have much better economies, and Amazon's going to deliver stuff to our houses. So it's going to be better than it was in other cases. That's it. I mean, we have to be realistic, I think, in recognizing that enormous change is possible. On the other hand, we have to be humble, because as has been shown over and over again, especially by Phil Tetlock at Penn, no one can predict the future. Get a bunch of experts like me making prognostications. It's really no better than monkeys throwing darts at a wall. So everyone should take what I say with an enormous grain of salt. I'm describing some cycles. I'm describing what's happening now. But, anything could happen tomorrow that changes things. So, don't get too alarmed. Take what I'm saying as a possibility. But don't go selling your house and moving to New Zealand.
I am fascinated. Go ahead, Liz.
Yeah, go ahead, Corey.
I'm fascinated and have such an affinity for the fact that you're an atheist, but you have such warmth, if I can say that, for religious folks, and even for the idea of religion, the value of religion. I really appreciate that there's a poetry in that dichotomy. That's a whole other podcast, if not a whole other series. But I would like to shoehorn I know we're going to get to some more questions of participants. Yes. We have plenty of them. I want to get to a self-serving question. Okay. It's what we refer to as the TPNR question. And we've already been talking about this, but I'd really like to put a pin on it. It's, what do you think each of us can do to be better able to share space with, have better conversations with, perhaps even nurture relationships with people across our differences? So it's like what we've been talking about. People who think differently than we do, have different beliefs than we do, get their news from different sources than we do. How do we do better at this? Talking politics, religion, without killing each other. Shameless plug.
No, thank you. That's a great question. So I would say the key psychological flip is to flip from defend mode to discover mode. So we can be in one of two states. Our brains are structured, animal brains are structured so that when there's something good, they get into approach mode, and then you have approach motivations and it feels good as you're approaching and you're consuming. But if there's a threat, boom, instantly defend mode kicks in within a second, totally changes everything up there, sends hormones out to the body. Social media has really put us much more, we encounter each other much more in defend mode or attack mode, not in discover mode. Whereas the early internet, you know, when you first got your web browser, wow, that was curious. That was discover mode. That was an incredible gift to humanity, it seemed. So if we can recapture, we each individually, so here's another way to put it. What game do you want to play? We can play the attack game where I try to get points from my team. We can play the I'm right game where I try to feel good because I'm right and I show you that you're wrong. Or we can play the persuasion game where I'm going to try to change your mind while sticking to my beliefs. Or you can play the learning game where my goal is actually to learn as much as I can about how the world works. Because acting on the world when you don't understand it actually makes things worse. A lot of activism really backfires. And I think there's a huge problem for the left these days. And this is part of the reason why the right is ascendant in many parts of the world. So flipping into discover mode is the essential first step. And there's a lot of ways to do that. I was very lucky. I mean, I got to do it because I was trying to write a book on politics, on left and right. So I literally, it was like my job was to be in discover mode about the other side. And I loved it. Like, it was so interesting. It was like getting into a cold pool. You know, at first it was like, you know, icky and painful, but like, then it was like, oh, actually, wow. Once you're in it, like, this is really interesting. So I sort of got there by an academic route. A lot of people get there through religious roots or religious conversion experiences or awe experiences, because what those always do, like, someone doesn't come back from one of these powerful religious experiences saying, you know, now I want to make as much money as I can and I want to defeat my enemies. Like, no, it's never that. It's more like you become less petty, more open-hearted, more open-minded, more loving. So there are a lot of ways to do it. And then a lot of people come to it from having a carefully curated or accidental experience of encountering the humanity of someone else. And that's what you guys are in the business of doing. That's what the Village Square really has pioneered and really has developed so well. And you have all this like secret sauce, you have all these like, you know, not tricks, but, you know, techniques you do if you're going to bring people together. Food is really important. Long ago, I suggested that we try to do experiments, like, let's try experimentally with alcohol. Like, if you encourage people to drink versus don't, you know, what happens? I mean, maybe it with psychedelics, you know.
Yeah. If you sing a song at the beginning, yes, or say the Pledge of Allegiance, what happens?
That's right. So, you know, it is what people say universally is, you know, when you encounter someone on the other side in the right way, you discover that, you know, they love their children. They have their, you know, hardworking, you know, you discover that they have many virtues. So there are a lot of ways. There are a lot of ways to do it, but the key is you have to get out of the game, you know, the game of attack or the game of gaining points. And again, social media makes us get into that prestige hungry game. So I guess the first step, as I tell my students, is regain control of your inputs, either cut up social media entirely, or, you know, it's useful for some things, you know, spend an hour or two a weekend on it. But, you know, if you're spending an hour or two a day, that's a huge amount of your life, and it's making you worse. It's making you a worse person.
Somewhere Monty Guzman is smiling.
Yeah, that's right. I love her.
We're all fans of Monty's, yes.
Yep, absolutely.
So in The Anxious Generation, you write about the collective impact problem, the collective action problem yes, that we have. And we've got a couple of questions that I wanted to ask that are sort of different variations of that. In a lot of the questions. So Katie asks, I've been advocating for civil discourse for a decade and a half, but often I feel like I'm shouting or rather speaking civilly into the wind. How can we be quiet loudly? How can we grow the movement when the news and online environments are so sensationalist and so many people, and I think this is really true, and it is a frustration we have, so many people are craving connection and thoughtful dialogue, but our dumb brains draw us towards clickbait and outrage.
Yeah.
How do we fight it when so many of us feel that way?
Yeah. So what's a collective action problem? A collective action problem is a very common term in the social sciences, where each of us does what we think is best for us, but that leads to a terrible outcome for us all together. So, you know, if each fisherman overfishes, he's better off. But then the next year, the fishing stock is depleted and the whole community collapses. And so especially for the parents in the audience, for anybody who's a parent who has a kid under 18 or certainly especially under 12, the only reason that parents give their kids a phone, I mean, at least for a lot of them, is because the kids said, "Mom, everyone else has an iPhone. And you gave me this, you know, this dumb watch or this flip phone or nothing. And I'm being excluded." And no parent wants their kid to be a loner or excluded. So it's a collective action problem because we'd all be better off if no kid had a smartphone before high school. It's horrible for, we've got to focus on middle school. That's where the maximum damage is done, especially to girls. Just get all this stuff out of the lives of middle school students. So we can solve the collective action problem if we all act together. Let me just lay out the four norms to solve the collective action problem, and then we'll get to the back to the answer to the question. So what I'm proposing in the book, I give a lot of specific suggestions in The Anxious Generation for what parents can do, but the four norms that are easy to do if we do them together and hard to do if we don't. Norm number one, no smartphone before high school. Just give them a flip phone. Norm number two, no social media before 16. They can have the rest of the internet. They can, they can communicate in all kinds of ways, but they don't need a hyper-viral platform like Instagram, and they don't need a highly addictive short-form video program controlled in part by the Chinese government. So no social media till 16. Phone-free schools. Every school, K through 12, has to say, you put your phone in a locker or a yonder pouch in the morning, you get it back in the afternoon. If you leave it in the pockets, then they're texting during class. Literally, and if some kids are texting, then they all have to be on. They don't want to be the only one who doesn't know what's happened. So phone-free schools. And then the fourth norm is far more childhood independence and free play. And this really comes from Lenore Skenazy and a project I have with her at Let Grow. If you go to letgrow.org, parents will find a lot of ideas to do at home or in schools. If you're the only one who sends your kid out, then you can get arrested or you'd be afraid. But if we're all sending our kids out to play in the afternoons, then actually everyone's better off. So those are the four norms to break out of the collective action problems. Now, I went through the time to do that because my answer to the questioner is, there are limits on what you can do as an individual because we're stuck in collective action problems. But if you play your part to try to solve the collective action problems, well, then collectively we can change this. We can really roll back the phone-based childhood and restore a play-based childhood. That would be gigantic. We all can play a part in that. When the book launches, we're building a website right now at anxiousgeneration.com. We're going to have a pledge asking people, will you commit to doing your part to roll back the phone-based childhood and restore the play-based childhood? Now, as for civil discourse, that's harder. And the democracy problems are harder than the childhood problems. The childhood problems we can solve. Like if we do these four norms, this will actually, not entirely, but this will really roll it back quite a way. Democracy problems are harder. And I think as an individual, I think we, we're concerned nationally, but I think acting locally is really the main thing you can do. If you're a philanthropist, support places like the Village Square and I should say, Constructive Dialogue Institute. I would urge people to go to Constructive Dialogue Institute, constructivedialogue.org. And we offer a program that literally teaches you a bit about moral psychology, how to start a conversation, how to be persuasive. So there you go. So there are all sorts of things you can do. If you have any influence at your company or at a high school or a university, assign the Perspectives Program from Constructive Dialogue. There are all kinds of ways that you can magnify your impact. But if all you do is strengthen a few relationships in your community with your family, if everyone did that, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Yes, I would like to continue talking for the next 8 hours, actually, but we cannot.
That's it.
Kami Akhavan, who is an extraordinary executive director at the USC Center for the Political Future, which is a great model for IOPs across the country, asked, should we be more focused on nudging leaders from the grassroots to trickle down pro-social behavior or trying to develop pro-social behavior and attitudes at scale at grassroots level? They're both important, but which do you think is more important?
Yeah, Well, so as a social psychologist, I'm thinking about parameter changes in our society. Like, what are the things that caused, you know, small changes? If you have a complex dynamical system and you do a small change in a parameter, you know, like if you have an ecosystem and you raise the temperature by 3 degrees, per, you know, permanently, that's going to have huge impacts. So in terms of thinking globally, I'm thinking parameter changes. I'm thinking social media regulation, you know, removing, you know, repealing Section 230. I mean, there are all sorts of things that would, change parameters at a global level. It's very hard to persuade at a global level. I mean, you know, it's very hard to persuade people using commercials, using political appeals, because people don't just like, oh, a message came into my ear and it has a certain structure and that's going to turn a key in my brain. It doesn't work that way. We're not persuaded by an idea, by a communication. We're persuaded by a person or an interaction. And so, you know, no, I wouldn't put a lot into like big messaging campaign. I don't think that's going to do anything. So I would say, you know, globally, look at parameter changes. Locally, look at small scale, grassroots stuff.
That's really helpful. So Henry McHenry with the Meeting of Opposites, actually, I think that's in Charlottesville. And he was at a talk that you gave recently. Save the culture by saving the university? Can we save the university without saving the culture? How connected are they?
Oh, that's a great question. So it's often said that culture is upstream from politics, but technology is upstream from culture. And so a lot of our political problems are clearly very related to our cultural problems, obviously. And I've been arguing that our cultural problems are tightly linked to our technological change. The early internet was great. The second wave of internet is destroying us, the social media era. So in terms of universities, you know, I've been really alarmed at what happened since 2014, 2015, when we abandoned our telos, our purpose, and became much more ideological. We lost the trust of America, not just of Republicans, but of centrists and moderates. And we violated our fiduciary duties to the truth. Now, I think this is crucial in this conversation, because as I said before, you know, I think we're heading into an era which may have extraordinary material prosperity. And I think AI for a while is going to, could massively increase prosperity, but we're going into an age of sociological fragility and possible disaster. And again, I wish we had good, I mean, there are some, actually, there's some actually conservatives. There are a few conservative sociologists that are very concerned about them, like James Hunter at UVA, Christian Smith, there are a few, but we're going, you know, I'm trying to convey these really abstract sociological academic ideas to you, like about Emil Durkheim and about evolution. Like, these are really hard things to understand and to convey. Imagine trying to go into this weird new world without any scholars or researchers, without universities that are doing their job. With, you know, if the university is just focused on social justice, they're not focused on truth, then we're flying blind. And so I feel like this is, you know, the way in World War II, the entire academic world in the US, the UK, everyone's like, okay, what can we do for the war effort? I think we should be like that. Unfortunately, a lot of people are like, what can we do for the war against Trump effort? Now, again, I understand that. I think Donald Trump is a unique threat to the country. Again, I understand why people are voting for them. There's a lot to dislike about the left and what's happening. So I'm not judging people who are voting for him, but I do think that that he is a unique threat to the constitutional order, especially his recent marks about Russia can do whatever the hell they want to our allies. That was, I mean, you know, how can it be that in our country, this doesn't end your presidential race? But yeah, that's the kind of bespoke realities that we're in. But we need our universities not just to focus on the partisan war, but of course they should be studying it, but not be partisans in it. But yeah, we need them to understand what the hell is happening to us.
So Corey, if you want to ask a last question, and then I've got a closing question I wanted to make sure I got to. Mm-hmm, Corey. Yes.
I'll steal from some of the questions that have been posed, one of which was, what are our strengths as humans that we can bring to the task ahead?
Oh, I love that question. That, you know what? Actually, wow, that actually gives me hope, that question. And the reason is because humans are amazingly adaptable creatures. And the human advance, while it has not been perfectly steady, you know, I am a fan of Steve Pinker and Robert Wright and others who pointed out that, yes, there are setbacks, but the long-term trajectory has been up and up and up. And it probably will be. You know, I'm talking, there could be a period of extraordinary disruption, but the network era could, in theory, really could bring us the best democracy ever. I mean, the early internet seemed to promise that we might be able to realize that. So what gives me hope about humans is that while we're amazingly complicated creatures, we are not fully selfish. We're actually very group oriented, which can be good or bad, but it's usually good. We are ethical creatures, not perfectly, but we care about it. We're a miraculous species. I mean, how humans made the jump from just forest-dwelling primates to living in comfort with people of all races, creeds, and colors. Not perfect harmony, but like, you know, in America, there's, you know, not much cross-racial violence. Again, things are getting worse because of social media. There are some issues, but if you keep your eye on human nature and you don't deify it, you don't say, oh, we're all so loving, you know, but you say, you know, we're complicated, but look at how far we've come. And so even if we face some setbacks, probably we're going to succeed in the end. So yeah, actually, yeah, that does give me hope.
That reminds me real quick of the East of Eden, the one of the best Bible studies, if you ever want to read it. And Steinbeck comes to the conclusion that Genesis chapter 4, when God speaks to Cain, he says, sin is crouching out the door and thou blank overcome it. And ultimately the conclusion that they come to is, it's not thou must overcome it as a command. It's not thou shall overcome it as a promise, as some of our popular pastors, but thou mayest overcome it. The much more nuanced, subtle translation.
You have the choice. You have the option. You have to decide. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
So okay. My last question is kind of a riff on that. I wanted to say to our audience that you asked so many good questions. I could keep us here for another couple of hours asking them. And so I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them, but I want to kind of come back to some of our colleagues again. You know, back when we started this work, there was not very many people out there doing it. And now there's just an incredible network of humans that, you know, I really think when I retire, I think I'm going to write the story of looking at them and the people who just like put their lives on hold, change their day jobs to start trying to work on this, which to me gives me so much hope. And one of them is Cheryl Gravey from a National Institute for Civil Discourse, a wonderful colleague. And she wrote something today that I wanted to share that frames this last question. She wrote, "I'll be listening for new possibilities for our humanity that may be emerging during this time of turbulence and transition." I just thought that was a beautiful way to put it.
Right.
And then we had so many questions about, you know, hope that humans can change and variations of hope. And then our colleague and friend, Dr. Jacob Hess, asked, he's now staff writer at the Deseret News, which is doing just wonderful writing and work on the problem that we're all talking about tonight. Is there hope even if things do break down? A rebirth that you could envision made possible by the natural dissolution of systems and approaches that prove to be unsustainable, that aren't working?
Oh, yes, yes. So let me expand on something I mentioned before, but it's very important for this conversation. I hope it'll be a direct answer. So there's a meme on the internet, which actually has a lot of social science behind it, which goes, hard times make strong men. Strong men make good times. Good times make weak men. Weak men make hard times. And every 80 years, and this is a theory from Howe and Strauss, every 80 years even before the revolution, but certainly since the revolution, Civil War, World War II, and the 2020s, 80-year cycles. And what this is really doing, there was a Muslim scholar in the 14th century, Ibn Khaldun, who talked about asadiyya, the binding force that keeps society together. You know, the Bedouins come sweeping out of the desert. They're tough. They take over. The children are rather comfortable, and then their grandchildren are really soft, and then another group comes. So our grandparents or whatever built these extraordinary institutions of the post-war order. They went through hell. They went through depression. They went through war. They came out strong. They were incredibly good citizens comparatively, And they built these institutions, but institutions decay, times change, and every 80 years, things break apart and we have to come up with new ones. And Americans did it after the Revolutionary War, they did it after the Civil War, they did it after World War II, and we're going to have to do it in the 20s, 30s. I think things are going to, you know, things will probably get worse in the 2020s, and then we need to have a rebirth in the 2030s. So that's our challenge. And if history is a guide, you know, we'll probably succeed. Now, of course, now there are many more threats that could have catastrophic effects that weren't present previously. You know, the odds are we're going to find our way through it.
Your answer is making me cry. So I'm not sure I can finish it.
She's
up,
getting all verklempt, John. What did you do, man?
I just wanted to say, Corey, first, I love you, dude. I love to hang out with you. Thank you for coming into our living room tonight to do this interview. And John, I just, your thinking and your big heart, it's changed the world in ways that I don't think I could ever really explain to the people on this call. Some of them know it, right? Because they've had the opportunity to interact with you, that they, you know, you are such a busy man. The whole idea that you took this time out to talk to us tonight, but you do it person by person and effort by effort. And I've seen you now do that for the 12 or 13 years that we've been hanging out. And I cannot thank you enough. I just cannot thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Liz. It's been an honor and a joy to work with you. I hope I can just say at the end here, I do hope that people will follow up by subscribing to my Substack, After Babel. It's free. There's no paywall. You don't have to give me any money. But afterbabel.com, that's where Zach Rausch and I are publishing our research. That's leading up to the new book. I hope people will consider pre-ordering the new book, The Anxious Generation. And I hope that people will just stay involved and do what they can. I'll leave it, you know, one thing I found over and over again, most people are reasonable. What's going on is the dynamics are making it seem different and they're empowering other people who are not reasonable. Most people are decent. Most people are reasonable. Don't lose your faith in Americans. Be concerned about the dynamics that are messing us up. Someone said they hope that human nature will change. Don't hope that human nature will change. It's not going to change. Hope that we find better ways to live together that bring out the better sides of our nature. We know it's possible. We've done it. We can do it again.
I'm getting comments that I'm not going to share now, but lots of comments about just how profound your work has been. So we'll share it afterwards. And thank you so much on behalf of Florida Humanities and the Village Square. We are so glad that you all joined us tonight. Good night.
Thanks so much, Liz. Thanks so much, Corey.
Corey Nathan back here with you. Listening to this talk and thinking through the important findings of Dr. Hite's book, The Anxious Generation, it really hits close to home. My kids are 23, almost 21, and 19, so they are right smack in the middle of this very generation. And I have to confess, the way we raised our kids, it fell into some of the traps that we talked about today, some of the traps that are discussed in the book that resulted now in a mental health that, for lack of a better description, is just more brittle than we planned or what we could have imagined. So, my kids grew up on smartphones, on social media, and at times they were getting into digital scraps that never would have happened when my wife and I were growing up, because social media is kind of like a digital version of Lord of the Flies. That book, I'm sure you've heard of it. It's where the kids get stranded on a desert island, and they kind of create this little subculture, no adults, you know, and they all become basically monsters. But in some ways, it's even worse, because in the digital world, there's virtually no accountability for, if you could imagine it being worse, but that it really is for those who act out and they default to cruelty. You know, when we were kids and we were around each other, you at least risk the possibility of getting punched in the nose. You know, there is something to that. So my kids definitely grew up and had to navigate in that environment. You know, don't get me wrong. We did the best we could, but there were a lot of things, and this is what's talked about in the book, that we just didn't understand. We had no equipping to imagine what this was doing to their brains. So, to one of Jonathan's points that he was making, there was a season when one of the kids was going through a particularly hard time, and a good buddy of mine, loves me, loves my family, he just said, "Corey, get that boy running." Meaning get him outside, get him on a football team, a soccer team, get him running track. Just get him out, get him running, get him around other kids, get that boy running. And he was right. There's plenty of research that underscores how being around other people, especially at the formative times in our lives, it changes the wiring in our brains. And a lot of that is covered in Dr. Hite's book. So if you haven't already, be sure to go out and get a copy of The Anxious Generation. It is so timely, such an important contribution to helping us all understand what's been happening, not just with our kids, but with all of us. And more importantly, what we can do about it. And with that, it's time to close out today. Please consider joining our members and supporting this programming. You can become a member for just $7 a month or $76 a year, and your business can join for $250. Go to villagesquare.us/donate to join today. While you're there, sign up for Village Square's newsletter to stay up to date with everything happening at the Village Square. Go to villagesquare.us and scroll to the bottom for the sign-up box. Funding for this podcast was provided through a grant from Florida Humanities, with funds from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Florida Humanities or National Endowment for the Humanities. We appreciate you listening to Jonathan Hite, The Anxious Generation. Until next time, we challenge you to reach out with an open heart and mind to someone who doesn't look or think like you. It changes everything, especially if you do it in person. We'll talk to you soon, and thanks so much for listening to Village Squarecast.